James chapter 1 verses 22 through 27. The fourth talk in a series on the book of James was presented by Rusty Rexius on May 16, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College Inc. 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
I used to dream, like many of you, that I was on my way to the U of O to take a final, and I forgot to go to the class. You've had that one, right? Actually, it started for me in junior high. In fact, I actually remember the teacher and the class, and I showed up, and I hadn't been there all year, and I was supposed to take the final. And then I started having the same thing after college, and now I dream that I get up here, and I forgot my notes, and I just freak. And I had the dream last night, and what did I do? I just made stuff up. That's just what I did. So every time we get in the car, I'm driving down the road, and I stop, and the notes are there. So fortunately, the notes are here. I did not forget them. I was thinking, I spend most of my time thinking, but I was pondering the whole process of studying. And I have been doing the same thing for a really long time. I get up early in the morning. I've done that for many, many, many years. I feed the dogs, I do the coffee, and I sit down, and before it gets light, most of the time before it gets light, I do my studying. That's just what I've always done. I can't do it at night. I literally, if I sit in a chair, Susie can attest, I sit in the chair. If it's after 8 o'clock, I'm out. So there's no hope for studying at night. So I do it in the mornings. Not that that matters. That just happens to be the time that I do it. And I was sitting there this morning, and I was studying away and making conclusions and drawing up ideas about what I thought was going on. And it dawned on me that, this is an interesting process that we do, especially studying the Bible. I don't really study anything else, so I don't have much to compare it to. But I realized that my MO, what I do, the way I roll, I've been given the opportunity to gain some skills. I have some exegetical skills. Whether they're good or not, I don't know, but I have some. So, that process is pretty straightforward. You open your Greek text and you do the whole translation bit. But what I realize is that what I spend a lot of my time doing is I have this notion that I can put myself in the chair, the shoes, the synagogue, whatever it is. I actually try to go there. And in this odd way, I've convinced myself that I'm there. And so as I'm thinking this study of James, and we'll talk about this in a minute about whether or not this is James writing a letter, or this is actually James speaking and somebody else is writing what he said. I think I have, I'm not in a fantasy world, but I actually feel like I'm sitting there and I'm in the synagogue and I think I know what's going on. I don't really think I'm hearing James. Don't think I'm weirding out here. But I feel like there's a sense in which I'm really there. And it dawned on me that that's how I've approached my study, is that I've tried really hard, whether I'm right or I'm not, to set myself where the voice was being spoken or the pen was being written. And then it dawned on me, after thinking through that, it's like, and I might be really, really wrong. Really wrong. I just may have totally missed it. But I don't think so. That has almost nothing to do with what I'm going to say. I just thought of that, and I thought maybe it would be helpful for you to hear how that goes. And I will mention one other thing about that. One of the most helpful things for me in going to Israel, where we're, Lord willing, headed again in 6 weeks, but staring at those places where the words were allegedly spoken or written, but seeing that and feeling the humidity or that was actually true in the Upper Galilee especially, but the going into the Sea of Galilee or whatever, there is a sense in which that's super helpful as you're trying to place yourself in that particular part of the world at a particular time so far removed from where we are today. So I just throw that out there as a little bit more about how I roll. Two things I wanted to mention about last week. By the way, I just want to say that your questions are very helpful and appreciated, even if you disagree with everything I say, because it does help me hone my thoughts a little bit and try to be clearer if I haven't been. Two things I wanted to say about last week. I mentioned that I felt like at the end of the hour we had last week that I felt like that we put life into three categories. The crisis category that we've been talking about, those things that come along that are the watershed events in our lives, those things that really test us, that we can all point to, or at least some, well, probably all of us, one or two or 12, but those things that we just go, yep, that was the moment when I was asked the question, do you or do you not believe? I think that was the third category. And those are not very often, I don't think. I mean, for most of us. Some of us, it's terrible how often it is, but for most of us, it's fairly infrequent. And then there's the other end of the spectrum, which I think I called the mundane, the things that just are the everyday, we do it, we don't think about it. It's just the things that we do, tying our shoes and cooking our dinner and driving to work or whatever it is. And while that's a great deal of our life, that doesn't create or cause or require a great deal of thought. We just do it. I guess there's some testing in there, I suppose, but that's not primarily what that part of life seems to be about. But then there's the middle. And what I suggested is it in the middle where the majority of our testing comes. Those things that are just seemingly part of everyday life but require us in the decisions that we're making, the normal, everyday, but meaningful decisions, they are the things that are asking us the question, who are we really? And I gave the example, two of them, I think, the basketball example. I remember the other one. But as we were leaving, Susie mentioned, you know, there was a third example that you could have given that would probably have been better, and she's right. So I'm going to give that example, but I want to clarify what I think I mean by what it is that we should come out of the middle knowing. Because I think that there is maybe, or there could be a misunderstanding, or at least I need to give more clarity to what I think should occur when we faced into those situations in the middle. I think those are the trials, the crisis, but more importantly, the normal trials of every day. What should we learn about ourselves and what should we do? The example that I'd like to give is one that I am all too often faced into, and I'm not proud of it. Never have been, I never will be. But I have this insatiable need to be recognized as mattering. I have to know that you see my value. I think this is maybe indicative in all of us. I know it's true of me. It seems like it's sort of got itself planted in our family, sadly. But when I'm in any situation and something is happening that I've had a part of, I need you to know that I had a part of it and that I need to puff myself up a little bit. But mostly, I just need you to know I matter. I'm important. And that happens to me all the time in my work environment, where things are happening, and it's usually with a small group of people, and names don't matter right now, but it's a small group of people, my peers at work, so to speak. And when something is happening, I got to make sure everybody knows what my part was in that. And I fight that all the time, all the time. But then comes the moment when somebody suggests that maybe I'm not exactly living up to my end of the deal. I might not be contributing as much as I maybe could otherwise. And just thinking about it, I tremble a little bit. That there's nothing you could say to me that would dig deeper into my core to suggest that I am not doing my part. And so my immediate desire and response is to tear that person down to shreds, to let him know or them know precisely how little they are in reality in comparison to me, the big one. So my test in that particular situation, nearly daily, is what are you going to do with what you now see in yourself? Because there's nothing about what I just described that's right, honorable, true, holy, righteous, any of those things. It's all evil. So when I face into those things, the question that I'm asked is, well, you have a certain belief about who you say, you have a belief about who you are, and what it is that God says about that and what you're supposed to do about that. But what are you going to do now? Are you going to act on everything, that desire within you to tear somebody down in order to build you up or not? But what I want to be clear about is what I think that ultimately the outcome of the test or the trial is not so much that I buckle up and do the right thing. That's a part of it. But really the ultimate, what should be the outcome of that is a pause, a recollection of what exactly is going on in my head, who I know that I am and who I feel like I am. The conclusion that I should come to at that moment is two things. What a desperate, desperate person I am, and what a tremendous need I need, what a tremendous need I have for mercy. Because if not for mercy, who I just described for me that I am is subject to ultimate condemnation. So the trial and then the ultimate question being asked is, and then the ultimate end of the question is, I need mercy. I desperately need mercy. And then the action is, and we're going to read a passage in a little while to speak to this, the action that comes out of my recollection and my understanding of my need for mercy is I in turn can be merciful. I don't have to puff myself up. I don't have to tear that person down because it's not who I want to be. But instead, I want to be somebody very different, and I act on that, not because somehow God is going to be pleased with my actions, but rather because I now see who I am or what I am and respond in that way. So at the end of the day, all of this stuff, I think, these trials, these tribulations, these tests, are so that I can recognize my utter and desperate need for mercy. Not that I would just behave better, because oftentimes I won't behave better. That's oftentimes, I mean, there is the time, hopefully many times, when behavior becomes part of my understanding, but behavior in itself is not the goal. It's my understanding of who I am in light of who God says I am. The second thing I wanted to say about last week, Ron asked a good question, and it had to do with the implanting of the word. And I want to clarify something that I said, but I don't know how clear it was. I said something along the lines that the logos of truth was the script or the plan of God that is real and meaningful and true. I think it's the ultimate and real creative purposes of God. And I was using that to describe the way in which God has written the entire script of all of creation, which includes me. There's no doubt about that. I'm in the script of all of creation because I'm here. But that script also includes the story of Jesus. That script includes what it was, who it was that Jesus was, what it is he came to do, and ultimately the purposes that Jesus had in being here. That script includes Jesus and the gospel story, the redemptive plan of God that's through him. And while it's true that I'm in the story, I'm in the logos of truth, I'm not the center of it. I wish I were, but I'm not. I'm not the center of the story. That would be Jesus. Jesus is the center of the story. He's the center. He's everything that matters. He's the only reason that God ultimately actually wrote the script. And everything that's true about that script, about Jesus being in the story, the gospel story, that I think is actually the implanted logos, what the script of creation means. What we understand the truth of that script to be, that's the implanted logos. It is what we are to come to know about why God has written the story at all, that is about Jesus, and how I am to relate to that. I think I said at the end of the question, it is eyes to see and ears to hear. And that, of course, that story, that's the message, the only message and the only thing that can save my soul. Nothing else can and nothing else will save my soul. So I'll reread that last verse. Verse 21, so rids oneself of all moral uncleanliness and abundance of depravity, and in humility receive the implanted message which is able to save your soul. Okay, hopefully that was helpful. We are now, believe it or not, going to finish a chapter in James. And in fact, I'm guessing that we may even be done early because I refuse to go on further than I've prepared, and I've prepared to the end of the chapter, and it may not take all this time. We'll see. Those are famous last words. So we are going to be looking at verses 22 of James 1 through 27 of James 1. As I was preparing for this, this is when we get into the portion of the passage when James starts to talk about doing. A believer does, rather than a believer only hears. And I was reminded that there are several passages in the New Testament that frighten me. Quite honestly, a whole bunch of the Bible frightens me in many ways, because it just seems to me that there's this question always, how do I fit in here? Am I fitting in here? But there are three passages beyond this one that I was remembering that frightened me. This doesn't have necessarily anything to do with what I want to say, but I'm going to read the passages that frighten me. They're all in Matthew. Maybe they frighten you too. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name we cast out demons, and in your name we performed many miracles. And then I will declare to them, says God, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. That frightens me. I don't think I want to be one who hears, I never knew you. In the same chapter of Matthew earlier, Jesus says, and you're all familiar with this one, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And many are those who enter by it. For the gate is small, and the way is narrow that leads to life. And few are those who find it. That frightens me. I hope I am one who finds it, and not one who has found the wide passage. And then, again in Matthew, clear over in 22, this is one of those passages. I don't think I actually understand completely what's going on here, but you've heard the story. This is the end of it. But when the king came to look over the dinner guests, and he saw that there was a man not dressed in wedding clothes, and he said to him, friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot and cast him into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen. That frightens me. I want to be one who is both called and chosen. Which leads me to the passage in James, where I believe that James is helping us, in this case his readers, but us, to know whether we are both called and that we're chosen. And it has to do with not only hearing what is true, but doing what is true, which is what these next few verses are all about. It frightens me a little bit because there is a sense in which, don't we, well, I won't speak for you, I always wonder a little bit if I am doing what it is a believer should do rather than just hearing what a believer should hear, which, like those other passages, frightens me. The passages that we're going to read, or the passage, I should say, that we're reading today, let me read it first. Verse 22, now become a doer of the message and not only a hearer, deceiving yourselves. For if someone is a hearer of the message and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in the mirror, for he observed himself and has walked away and has instantly forgotten who he is. But the one having looked carefully into the telos, or telost, law of liberty, or freedom, and having continued on, not having become a forgetful hearer, but rather a practical doer, this one is blessed in what he does. If someone supposes himself to be religious, yet is not holding his tongue in check, rather deceiving his heart, this one's religion is empty. This is pure and unsullied religion in the sight of God and Father, to be concerned about the orphaned and the widowed in their tribulation, and to preserve oneself without blemish by the world. Verse 22, now become a doer of the message and not only a hearer, deceiving or deluding yourselves. I think this is a bit of a transition into a new thought, but it's clearly not unrelated to the previous points. We are supposed to receive what God has said and what he's written. There's no doubt about that. We are to receive that and to know that it's true in our hearts. Because isn't that the ultimate question is, what is in your heart? I was remembering this week, for some reason, an unrelated situation, but I quoted this passage to somebody, the eyes of the Lord search to and fro, looking for the man with the perfect heart. So that there is no doubt that ultimately it is the heart that is at question with respect to God, that's for sure. But there is, I believe, and I think James believes, there is a necessary transition. There's something that should happen and always should happen from when someone says they believe to what someone actually does. You might say that there is this question about whether or not Torah is being lived out. We all know this. This isn't unfamiliar to any of us. I don't think anybody would argue with the notion that we ought to walk the talk. We are supposed to practice what we preach. We are supposed to put our money where our mouth is. I would be surprised if anybody has problems with that. In fact, I think there was a great debate not that many years ago about this very subject within the Christian community. If I remember right, the one side of the debate was what I think was called lordship salvation. And on the other side of the debate was, I don't know what they called it, I think of it as the once saved, always saved people. And this was the question that was at hand. Does it matter what you do as a believer once you've become a believer? Is there any sense in which you have to live like a Christian in order to be saved? And one side of the debate, the once saved, always saved, again, I'm sure that's not what they called it, that's what I'm calling it, said, doesn't matter. Said the prayer, drove your stake in the ground, whatever euphemism or analogy you want to use for becoming a believer. You're saved, you're in. As the Major Thomas from Cape and Ray always said, you're out of hell and into heaven. The once saved, always saved camp, I don't know how much of this they really believed, but it just simply didn't matter how you lived your life. Once you got yourself into the pearly gate, so to speak, by saying the prayer, naming Jesus as Lord and all that, the other side of the camp was, no, it's true. And there is something very real about what needs to happen in that realm of naming Jesus as your Lord and Savior. But that's just a part of the story, that there is this matter of what are you actually doing as a Christian? And one who isn't doing as a Christian can't call themselves a Christian at all. So what we're talking about is nothing particularly new. I would maybe not call it lordship salvation. I would call it living your life in the light of what you believe. Here, anyway, it would surprise me if anybody thought that it's not important to live your life, walk in the footsteps, and in the light of what you say you believe. I would be shocked if that wasn't what I'm just sure that's what most of you understand your Christian life to be about. But there's a trickiness to this, it seems to me. And I think this is what James was aware of, and he no doubt was seeing this in the lives of those around him. It is tempting here to think of James's audience, or who he is speaking of here, as fellow observant Jews, especially the Pharisees, and saying, you say you believe and you honor God, but look how you're actually living your life. You're hypocrites. And I remember some of the comments that Paul made with respect to his observation of the Pharisees and saying they ought not steal and then they steal. And there were a number of other examples that he gave where they say one thing and they do something entirely different. Or certainly Jesus' criticism of the Pharisees was the same. You're not living in light of what you say. And it's true, they weren't. And there is absolutely some critical thinking and there is a just criticism in that. But I don't think that's actually what James is talking about. I think James is actually speaking to fellow believers. Jesus and Paul weren't speaking to believers, I don't think. James is speaking to believers. And they're claiming to have received this message, this truth, but it appears that they're not actually living in the light of the message they received. That's different from the other folks who are just simply not doing what Torah says you're supposed to do. These people have embraced, at least to some degree, a message of truth, and they're not living their lives in the light of it. James says, that such people are fooling themselves. They're deceiving themselves. They're deluding themselves. So what does he mean? Well, if I'm right about the Logos of truth, and that being the grand script that God has written for all of humanity, which includes the very truth about Jesus, and him being the center, and all that that entails for a believer, if I'm right about that, and if I'm right that such a message implanted in the heart allows one to see and to know and to grab hold of what that actually means to me, or in this case to James's readers, that is my utter need for mercy and the gift that comes to those that receive that. If I'm right about that, and if I'm embracing that, then there is no other way that I can live in the long run than with that at the very forefront of my mind, guiding everything I say, everything I do, and everything I think. It is my light, and I'm to walk by that. And if I'm not walking by that, I'm deceiving myself. I don't get it. I never did get it. I'm deluding myself. And what would that deceit or that delusion actually be? Again, if I'm right about the message that encompasses the entire story that God has written, and that includes the center of it all pointing directly at Jesus in order that I and every other believer look to Jesus as a window into who I am and my utter need for mercy, and I say that I see that as the truth about God and all that he is up to in the world, and it does not make its way into the way that I actually live and the decisions that I'm making, then I have really not heard the message at all. I couldn't have, or I wouldn't be living the way that I am. More specifically, what I'm actually deceived about is that I am one of those people who will receive the crown of life. I'm not one of those people. That crown of life that comes from God to those to whom he is merciful. So can I narrow down what it would be to actually look like, what it would be, and what it would look like to be a doer? Can I narrow it down? What does one look like when they do? And I think I can. I think Micah did that for us. I simply do justice, I love mercy, and I walk humbly. That's how I do what I believe. I do justice, I treat everybody in exactly the same way. I don't squish, squash, or step on those that I can or want to or easily could. I love mercy, I love the mercy that God has shown to me, and I love the mercy that I can extend to others. That's what I do. And I walk humbly. I walk humbly as one not better than anybody else, with no need to prove myself to anybody or anything. And I'm not deciding that I'm one who knows better than God. That's how I walk humbly. I think this is precisely what it means to be a doer who has heard the message. And this takes shape in a myriad of ways. And you all know exactly what it looks like when you see it. You know what it looks like to do justice, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly. And you know exactly what it looks like when you don't. You know how many times you've seen injustice, you've seen unmercy, and you've seen not humble by those who say they believe. It is true with Christians so often in the way that they treat other people. It is the most embarrassing thing about being a professing Christian, is the way that most Christians treat other people, without humility, without mercy, and without justice. So does this fit the context of James? Well, it certainly does looking forward. We're not there yet, but it will, trust me. And I think it does looking back. The circumstances that James's audience find themselves in requires a response. Based on what at least I think they understood the whole of the message to be, their right response would not only be to bow to the prerogative and the authority of God to write the story in any way he sees fit, but also in the very midst of the circumstances they find themselves in, they are to come to terms with how they are to respond and to treat the very ones that have put them in the situation that they're in. They must decide with respect to those people whether they are going to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. To not do that, having heard the message, would be to deceive yourself, both that the message had truly been heard at all and that such a one would stand to receive the crown of life. As I said, this is frightening because doing justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly does not come easily, and it certainly does not come naturally. So what does doing the message not mean? This is something we know all too well also. What it is not is abiding by a set of rules or requirements that somehow establishes merit, that one might be fit and deserving to receive the crown of life. It is not establishing ample evidence that one is worthy of God's favor. In an odd and strange way, doing seems to be more reactive than proactive. You are reacting to the message of truth, and then you're doing. There's some proactiveness in that. But it's not doing something in order that you not have to hear or understand or even listen to the message. That's the wrong story that we've all been told for years. Doing something in order to not be punished. But rather, what we're talking about here is more reactive to what is just true of me and who I am and what God, who God says I am, and then responding rightly. I had never thought of it like that before, and there's a sense in which proactive is right, but in the context here, it seems more reactive than it does proactive. Verse 23, if someone is a hearer of the message and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in the mirror, for he himself has walked away and has instantly forgotten who he is. This is a pretty powerful picture, and I think you all, if you've thought about it for a minute, you can appreciate you're looking at yourself in the mirror. I'll talk to that in just a minute, and then leave, and you just forgot what you looked like. That's actually happened to me before. I don't remember why. But there was some weird situation when I was, I don't remember why I was even looking in the mirror, but this weird sort of, I forgot what I looked like. That's completely unrelated to anything I'm saying. I just had happened to me one time. I'm losing it maybe. So I looked up this word observe. That's the verse 24, the second half of what I read. For he observed himself and walked away. To observe, to consider attentively, to fix one's eyes or mind upon. There sort of seems to be almost a study of oneself, in a sense, an admiration. Ah, look at me. So I think James's analogy here is fairly clear. You look in the mirror, whether you're looking with admiration or not, and you know who you are. At least you think you know who you are. You see the outline, you know the color of your hair, your eyes, you know what you look like. And then you walk away from the mirror, and you instantly forget. I don't remember the color of my hair. I don't remember the color of my eyes. I don't remember what my chin looks like. I have forgotten who I am. It seems that James's point is that one can be utterly convinced and even know what they believe. They know what they look like. Take the analogy. They know what they believe. They're convinced of it. They just spent 6 hours in a Bible study, and there's no doubt about what they believe. They know what they believe. And when they get into the reality of their life, they walk out the door into life, they completely forgot. None of it set in. They forgot. They forgot everything that they had just learned or everything that they said they believed. I love the movie Hook. And there's a line in Hook when Captain Hook is trying to get Peter to fight him. And Peter's looking at him and he's like, I don't know what you're doing. I don't even know why you want to fight me, because he'd forgotten. And Hook looks at Schmidt. And he says, he's forgotten everything. It's exactly what I thought about here. I walk out of my Bible study into life, I've forgotten everything. I behave in a way completely inconsistent with what I said I believe. That's the picture that I think James is writing. And again, I'd be surprised if everybody can't relate. We all know what that's like. The example that I've heard before, but there's some truth to it, is everybody has driven out of this kind of place, church, into traffic, and at least had the temptation to give somebody the single finger salute. Just, and maybe you did it, but you at least had the temptation to do it, having forgotten everything you just heard in church. Stupid example, but we've all been there at some level. We've all felt it. We've all know it. We all have lived it. Is it deliberate? Maybe not. Probably not. And yet it is very telling of what's true and what's actually in our hearts. I think we should be careful here not to confuse what we do as a result of our rebelliousness as creatures with how we find ourselves when in rebellion. And what I mean by that is we're all rebellious and will always be rebellious. There's nothing that's going to stop us from being rebellious. That's not what James is talking about. That's not actually, I think, what the New Testament is talking about. The New Testament is talking about what you do as a rebel. It's not the rebellion that's the problem. Well, ultimately, it is the problem. But the question is, what are you going to do with your rebellion? How are you going to respond to your rebellion? How are you going to work with your rebellion? It's not that you're a rebel. It's what are you doing as a rebel that is the important question. As we all mature in our rebellion, there is stuff that we won't do anymore. That's true. We wise up. We don't do the dumb stuff we used to do as the rebels that we are. But again, this is much more about how we respond and we react and how we move on when we are faced with the question, what should I do? Again, I suspect that this is not puzzling to any of us. Verse 25, but the one having looked carefully into the telos law of liberty and having continued on, not having become a forgetful hearer, but rather a practical doer, this one is blessed in what he does. What I think he's doing here, this is the opposite of looking into the mirror and forgetting who you are. So this is the counterpoint to that. Instead, this one, assuming he's speaking of the believing person, has looked carefully, or actually one of the, I like the translation better, I probably should just use it instead, stooped to look into this thing called the telos law of liberty, or the telos nomos, that's the Greek word there, of freedom. I'm still juggling with this notion, but I think I've got it. So you're going to have to just bear with me, and hopefully this will make some sense. If it doesn't, then I will try to clarify. What does it mean to look carefully into this telos nomos of freedom? Well, telos is that word that comes from the word telos. It's the adjective here. So it's something along the lines of goal or completed result, the end product, the point of the exercise, something along those lines. The nomos, which is oftentimes translated law, I like something more along the lines here of rules or agreement for freedom. I think the freedom here is ultimately the freedom or the liberty that we have released from sin. I think this is the same thing as eternal life, something related to eternal life. So someone who has looked into, stooped over, and studied carefully and concluded the completed result of the way in which one becomes truly free. That's what you would stoop to study, the telos agreement for freedom. Someone who has fully vetted the reality of the rules by which one is free. Namely, one submits to and lives their life in the light of this, regardless of the sacrifice and the cost. If my understanding is right, then here's what he would be saying. When one has truly studied and come to terms with this true message, the message of truth, what that really is, that it is that life really is a process authored by God to come to terms with our desperate need for mercy, and how that realization plays out in not only how we see ourselves, but the way that we see and treat others, and one stays the course, does not bail, refuses to turn away, and instead acts on what that one concludes, that one will receive what he wants: freedom, safety, the crown of life, or as we saw earlier, the dikaiosune, which comes from God. So one, having studied, looked carefully into what is the completion, what is the result, what is this activity, how is it that we come to this place, having looked at the agreement that this takes to do it, and how we are all told we are to get the freedom we desire, and we don't bail, that one who has continued on, not having become a forgetful hearer, not forgetting everything that that one concluded, not jumping out of what he just concluded he believed, but instead a practical doer, we're going to get to that in a minute, that one is blessed in what he does. He has counted the costs. Move forward, that one is blessed in what he does. Having come to that conclusion, and now facing into my circumstances, rather than forget all of that and do whatever I want, instead, I respond as an attentive creature. And what do? I do justice, I love mercy, and I walk humbly. That, I think, is what it means to be a practical doer. And what is the outcome of such a one? Well, that one is fortunate in what he does. That is to say, this is the one who receives what he seeks. What he does, justice, mercy, and humility, brings him what he truly wants. I note here that this is not a promise to succeed in your endeavors when you do so by following God's rules. I can't tell you how many times I have heard over the years and very recently that having followed the rules, these sorts of rules, the do-good rules, that God will bless my endeavors. The word that gets thrown around is that he will favor me. And what they mean by that is that it will go well for me if I just do the right thing. In other words, what they mean by going well for me has little to do with what I really care about, namely my crown of life, eternal life, the kaiosune from God. What they mean is my endeavors will be blessed in what I'm actually doing. Or translated, I'll make a little money, or I'll be a happier person, or whatever. And they use this verse to say, well, it says right here that the one who, however they translate all that stuff about the telos law of liberty, and not becoming a forgetful hearer, but rather a practical doer, what they concentrate on is this one will be blessed in what he does. Well, I don't think that has anything to do with being successful in my endeavors. It has everything to do with ultimately being blessed in what I do. In other words, being blessed after the life that I've lived is completed. I'm betting that you have heard similar things. Now James takes us to what not doing looks like. If someone supposes himself, verse 26, to be religious, yet is not holding his tongue in check, rather deceiving his heart, this one's religion is empty. James is giving some very specific examples. Going back to my example, it's the easiest one for me to relate to. Let's say that I fancy myself as one who believes, as I do. And the circumstances present themselves, which they do, where dressing somebody down, ripping them a new one, whatever you want to call it, is absolutely in order. That's the thing to do. That's what the circumstances call for. What do I do? What I used to think, and I'll bet this rings true with a bunch of you, what I used to think and what I was told, you've heard that term, just let go and let God. Remember that one? It's still out there somewhere. What I was told is that when I'm ready to just tear into somebody wrongly, that there was some way that I could just release myself, or whatever the words were, let go of me and just let God do the talking. Just let the Spirit flow. And the whatever it is that you want to say won't come out. Something different will come out. God will take over and insert the words into your mouth. Let go and let God. Then there was the next step that I remember hearing that wasn't quite so blatant, but it was behind the scene a little bit, that over time, what would happen was if I let go and I let God enough, those thoughts wouldn't even enter my mind. I wouldn't even have that question about whether I should dress that person down or not, because I'd let go and let God enough to where God is in permanent residence. And I simply just have to sit back and let God do his thing. It wouldn't even be a struggle for me anymore. Now, granted, I'd have another struggle come along, but that one was whipped, and I would just concentrate on the next one. Well, needless to say, I hope I don't think any of that's true. There's no doubt that God is involved in my life and how I'm responding, but it is not a matter of letting go and letting God. It is not a matter of hoping that over time I'm going to get good enough to where those sorts of things don't even enter into my mind. What I do now, what I think James is suggesting now, in the midst of those circumstances, I process. That's what I do. I process. I recognize right then and there what it is I want to say, and I desperately want to say it. Lots of times I do say it. But I recognize that I want to say it, and I confirm in my own mind that what's about to come out of my mouth, which is indicative of who I am, is not who I want to be. I think that this is what James is talking about. That's not the person that I want to be. That's not the sort of thing that I want to come out of my mouth. That's not the sort of heart that I would wish to have in order that those things would even enter my mind. I don't want that. What I want instead and what I need is mercy, because I just recognized who I am and what I am and what that means to me. And I fight back. I fight back what very naturally is ready to come out. I hold my tongue. And I don't actually hold. Sometimes I should actually hold my tongue. But I don't lash out, because that's not what I want to do. That's not who I want to be. And when I've actually gone through the hard work and process of this, I don't lash out towards God and I don't lash out towards others. I hold my tongue in check. And I stumble and I stammer and I stutter, and it's anything but simple. But that's what I do. And then hopefully, I do justice. And I love mercy and I walk humbly. And when that's all said and done, I extend grace. That's what I do, because that's what I want after the process. What I say, I believe, is simply no good to me. It's what I do, of my belief that is what is good to me. This can sound like works. Some of you maybe thought it. Well, makes it sound an awful lot like what you're saying is you just pull up your bootstraps and be a good Christian. That's what it sounds like you're saying. And in some respects, I kind of am saying that. I kind of am saying that you do pull up your bootstraps and you do decide what you're going to do and why you're going to do it. But the only reason you'd ever pull down and reach your bootstraps, and the only reason you'd ever decide to do something different than what comes into your mind and into your heart, is because God did a miracle in your mind and in your heart. He's given you the notion, the desire, the ability to even see anything at all that is the matter. And with that knowledge that he's given you, I do. And if that's works, okay. I don't think those are the works that God has a problem with. By the way, this is one of the problems that Luther had with James. Sounds like works, doesn't sound like faith. Well, Luther missed that. Not many times that I would say that I think Luther got it wrong, but he got it wrong. He missed the point. It is living in the light of what you believe, and it is the life of a believer to do. Verse 27. This, he says, now back to the uncontrast. Uncontrast is pure and unsullied religion in the sight of God and Father. To be concerned about the orphaned and the widowed in their tribulation and preserve oneself without blemish by the world. So James is saying that I've just told you what unpure and sullied religion looks like. That's the one who deceives himself, doesn't hold his tongue in check. The one who simply does not match his actions with what he says is his belief. So what would it look like to match what you say you believe with what you actually do? Well, he says, let me give you a couple of examples. He says, as one example, to be concerned about the orphaned and the widowed in their tribulation, to preserve oneself without blemish by the world. There's at least two ways to go here. One way is that James is introducing a second example of doing. The first example is holding your tongue in check. Now here's a second example of what it is to do rather than just hear. This doing, that is the second doing, is the responsibility clearly given in Torah to care for widows and orphans. That's not debatable. Here you go, in case you wonder. Deuteronomy 14, 28 and 29 says, at the end of every 3 years, you must bring all the tithe of your produce in that very year, and you must store it up in your villages. Then the Levites, because they have no allotment or inheritance with you, the resident foreigners, the orphans and the widows of your villages may come and eat their fill so that the Lord may bless you in all the work that you do. There are lots and lots of other references to making sure that the widows and the orphans are cared for. But this is an interesting subject. I started looking at this, oddly enough, because of the people standing on the street corners with the signs. Now, how I got to widows and orphans from that doesn't really matter, but I did. Started looking a little more at what the Bible actually says about widows and orphans. And there's no doubt at all, I'm clear, that God has given clear instructions that the widows and the orphans should not be forgotten or abandoned. And the reason that they should not be forgotten or abandoned is actually fairly simple, but that we forget because there's no man to care for them. In that particular culture, if a woman was widowed or a child was orphaned, the one who was there to care for them was no longer there anymore. But what's interesting about that is that the woman, when the man died, if she was widowed, she would likely have a dowry and a child an inheritance. So it wasn't as though they were destitute, necessarily. Some of them were, but not usually. It wasn't that they were destitute that they needed to be cared for. Instead, they were taken advantage of. And it was true that what was absolutely certain, that the one who was there to protect them had been taken away. And so what would oftentimes happen in that particular culture? Well, again, it wasn't that the orphan would just die on the street corner because he or she were hungry, or the widow, the same thing. What would happen is that the people who had means would take advantage of them and steal what they had. Very often, we have two different occasions of that. That's actually what I think Micah is about, or a lot of it is about. He says in Micah 2:9, you wrongly evict widows among my people from their cherished homes. You defraud their children of their prized inheritance. So we'll notice that the widow had a home and the child had an inheritance. It wasn't that they were destitute. It's that those who were in the position to take it did. They took advantage of them. They squished them because they could. They stole them because it was easy. That was what was the problem. Malachi 3:5 says something sort of similar. He says, I will come to you in judgment. I will be quick to testify against those who practice divination, those who commit adultery, those who make promises, and those who exploit workers, widows, and orphans, who refuse to help the immigrant and in this way They show me no fear, says the Lord, who rules over us all. Same idea. Again, it isn't just handing out things to widows and orphans. That's fine, but that's not what the issue is here. Widows and orphans need to be protected. They don't need to be fed or necessarily just housed. It's obviously not wrong in any way to take care of widows and orphans in the way we normally think of it, certainly when they can't fend for themselves. But it seems sort of extra evil, like ultimately evil, to actually take advantage of their plight. That was a side note. Back to James. He could just be saying that to hear those instructions given in Torah, the ones that I read and others, to take care of or not take advantage of and not actually do anything about it, that's what sullied religion is. That's what a forgetful hearer is. Torah says do this, don't take advantage of the widow or the orphan, and if you don't take advantage of the widow or the orphan, you're doing what you believe. You're not a forgetful hearer. The effective doer will be sure the widow and the orphan is cared for in their tribulation, and there is nothing wrong with that. I don't know how many of you have been to an orphanage. I've been to one. We went to one in Mexico. It's an incredible experience. It's the most humbling thing I've ever done. So I'm not down on orphans or orphanages. I'm not saying that there's anything the matter with being caring and looking after orphans. But I'm not exactly sure that's precisely what James has in mind. I think what he's talking about is this other notion of taking advantage of them in a way that was going on at this particular time. And it wouldn't surprise me, actually, now that I think about it, given what seems to be the case with the people that have taken advantage of these believers and exploited them because of their belief, same people very well could have been taking advantage of widows and orphans. I don't know that, but that wouldn't surprise me at all. That's one of the things that James could be saying is what it would mean to, how did he put it? That is what pure and unsullied religion is. But there's another way to take this that seems to be a little more in line with the argument. That other might be right. But remember the whole unbridled tongue thing? That was the example he just gave before. It could be that what he means is that we be concerned that they exhibit value, meaning, and worth towards the widows and the orphans. To actually think about and speak of those people as wholly equal, as fellow children in the eyes and the heart and the mind of God and of us. And more specifically, to not speak of them and act as though they were worthless or trash or cursed. There was the notion at that time that when, or at least in some cases, where if a man died, the reason he died was the widow was cursed. Or if an orphan's parents were killed, it was the orphan that had, there was something wrong with the orphan. That there was something that God was teaching them or punishing them or whatever. And so it would be very simple for somebody to cast disparagement on such a person that God obviously didn't think much of them or they wouldn't have killed the husband or taken their parents. And so what James could be saying is, no, that's not how you think about those people. That is not how you should treat the widow and the orphan with your tongue. These same people were oftentimes seen and spoken of as the enemies of God. And as such, they were likely spoken of poorly, treated with contempt, and probably taken advantage of. James would be saying to check your tongue, bridle your tongue with respect to these folks. And then after that, obviously, do what Torah says. You don't take their food and you don't take their privileges. You treat them with respect. In the end, I don't think the two options are all that different. They finish in the same place, but it makes more sense to me that James is actually speaking of how one speaks of the widow and the orphan rather than just simply how one treats of them. Could be wrong about that, but that's where I've landed. Finally, without blemish, by or from the world, it is just a way of saying that you're not influenced by the way the world suggests that one behave. Somebody who is pure religion, pure and unsullied religion, is not influenced by the way the world suggests we behave. And in this particular case, the worst one would not take advantage of the weak just because they are simply not important. Who would care? Who would notice? Who would even blink? Don't worry about it. I have some notes here I've entitled Careful Exegesis, which is what I'll end with. What this isn't saying is that true religion is caring for widows and orphans or the poor. Those are wonderful and amazing things to do, but James is not actually making the case for taking care of the needy. What he is making the case for is actually living your life in the light of what you believe. He is arguing that one cannot say he has received the message and then with a sort of reckless abandon live one's life as if no such belief exists at all. He gives as an example the treatment of widows and orphans, but that is simply because that is what would have resonated and made sense to all who were listening. It is not the linchpin example of what it means to be a believer. It is simply an example of how one lives his life as a believer. Culture said to dismiss these folks, and God said to pay attention to these folks. The question is, what will you do, says James. I doubt if James were writing today that this is the example that he would have given as a way to test pure and unsullied religion. For that matter, I don't even know if he would have brought up widows and orphans. What would James use as an example today? I don't know. Sexual identity? Bathrooms? Probably something more along those lines. The last thing I wanted to do, and it will only take a minute, is to go back to Leviticus 19. Remember that I suggested that one of the options of James is that this is James having preached a sermon, or several sermons, in synagogue after a Sabbath Friday night, Shabbat, where the Torah portion that was read was Leviticus 19 through 20, I think verse 8 or 9 or so. And that what the book of James is a compilation of a series of sermons that James gave on that portion of the Torah, Leviticus 19 through 20, whatever it is, and that James was speaking to his congregation, I don't remember, that's certainly not what they called him, but his peeps in his synagogue in Jerusalem, and that the compilation of those, well, and then afterwards, they taught maybe every night of the week, and that James was just teaching on this section of Leviticus relative and relevant to the circumstances that those people were facing in Jerusalem, in that messianic community, and in the peril that they were likely in, and that his disciples gathered up all those sermons, and we have the book of James as a result of that. And somewhere along the way, either James or all of the folks in that particular synagogue thought that it would be helpful to send the sermon set to all of the Jews in the diaspora, because all of them would have been facing the same sort of situation. Remember, that was, it's called a yalkut or a yalkut. That's what James is. Well, I don't know if it is or it isn't. Like I said, I kind of lean that way, but I'm not convinced of it necessarily. However, I just want to read this little section, and just so I don't say anything about it, you just might listen if you find anything familiar from what we've just been talking about. This is down, I won't go through the whole entire first part of Leviticus, but I will read this. Now, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of the field, neither shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyards, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit from your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger, for I am the Lord your God. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. You shall not swear falsely by my name, this is coming up later in James, so as to profane the name of the Lord your God. I am the Lord. You shall not oppress your neighbor, nor rob him. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you, and all night until morning. You shall not cause a deaf man nor a place of stumbling block before the blind, but you shall receive your God. I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but you shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord your God. There are some familiar topics there to the first chapter of James. There are many more to come. 5 minutes. I went a little longer than I thought. With a comment, question, rebuke, or correction.
Thank you, Rusty. I have a question for you. In 25, what if by perfect law or teleos law, he has in mind exactly the law, which if he's writing to fellow Jews, they would still be under, they would be concerned with. But it's teleos in that it's been made complete by the inclusion of the new covenant. So now what he has in mind is, if you really are concerned with obeying God and doing what he has asked of us, and that being the law, which has now been made perfect by the inclusion of the new covenant, and which he's going to then call the law of liberty, then you have to ask yourself the question, well, what is liberty of? Well, clearly it's not to do whatever I want, because he's going to go on to say, which means doing these things. But if it's the law made complete by the fact that now it's been revealed to us how mercy will be secured, then it's the law of freedom from condemnation, you know, the law that has been shown to us how God will perfectly and ultimately secure our freedom from condemnation. I wonder if that would make sense of what he means there, and then it would make sense also of why what he would go on to say would be very much in keeping with the heart of the law, which is very much about doing in your life actions, going about in the world in a way that reflects and mirrors the values of your creator God, you know, being concerned with justice and being concerned with mercy and truth, et cetera, which was precisely what Jesus said we should take seriously. What do you think about that?
I didn't go down exactly that same road, but I did go down one like it, trying to make sense of that nomos there, meaning the law like we normally think of it, Torah, or something like that, which would be fine, except for I couldn't make, to me, that didn't really fit in what he had been trying to, he hasn't been arguing about the law. He's not really arguing about anything, but he hasn't really brought that into the picture yet. So it didn't make sense for me, at least at this point, to think that he jumped to that out of sort of nowhere with respect to the actual law. Now, granted, I think he had one right behind him while he was preaching, or he had it open. And obviously, the law was a huge part of everything they did. But in this particular case, I couldn't make that as tidy as I wanted it. So I went for an alternate view of what the word nomos means, which, I mean, you know, that's got a wide variety of options there. So what you have just said is true, for sure. I'm just not sure that's exactly what he's trying to communicate here.
So in 22 and 23, when he talks about being doers of the word and not hearers only, you don't see him as having in mind, I am teaching you out of God's word. Don't just hear what I'm saying, but do it. Do you have something else in mind?
Well, I have taken that whole picture of what he's telling them to do as referencing the bigger story of what God is up to in the world, not just specifically with reference to the law itself. It plays itself out in the law itself for sure. That's what they had to live by. That was their instruction book, so to speak. But I'm not sure that that's exactly what he's pointing to right here. I think he has a bigger picture in mind. I think I called it the meta story last week, something that's a little more broad than just Torah.
Right, and that's why I'm wondering if by then saying teleos law, it is bigger than just what they had in Torah, because it's including what we know now through Jesus and his teaching, and the fact that now we have the law made complete.
Yeah, could be.
I really appreciate what you've done. There's one thing I'm having a terrible time tracking through this.
Yep.
And the reason is I don't understand. I don't know what the unifying theme is. And I think there at the end you said that perhaps the unifying theme was James preaching through parts of Leviticus. But I have, when I read through that section with you, just said this and then this and then this and then that. And I'm okay if that's what the way it is. But a list of things is much more difficult for me to think on and ponder on than something that has more of a unifying theme. I wondered if you had a quick one, or if you wanted to bring that up next week.
Can I just make something up?
Yeah.
And I talked about, I don't know if you were here the first week or not, but I talked a little bit about that. It's a terribly frustrating book because of that to me, especially for those of us who like figuring out arguments. This isn't one of those. However, I don't think it lacks a unifying theme. And so far, the unifying theme, I think, is the circumstances that you find yourself in, they're there for a reason. What are you going to do with it? That's the unifying theme. There are, and I'll go back to the meta story, but there is a story that God is telling in all of creation. You've been inserted into that story, and he's asking you a question. How are you going to respond to me, God, and the smaller story, the gospel truth that you've said you believe? What are you going to do with that in light of the circumstances you find yourself in? So I think this whole first chapter has been Here's where you are. Here's why you're there. What are you going to do about it? And he pops in these examples as ways to answer the bigger question, what are you going to do about it? That's why I don't think this is a ditty on orphans and widows or checking your time. Those are just there to help figure out what is it you're going to do with your life. So it gets a little more specific as we go, but I don't think we're ever going to be able to go, that's what James was trying to say right there. I don't know if we get that. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll all figure that out. And if we do, it'll be like in 2020 when I'm actually done. All right. Thank you all very much.